So Bryn William Jones, Director of the Bioethics Program at Faculty of Medicine, University of Montreal, Director of the Axe Éthique et Santé de Population of Quebec, and as I said, ex-director of this Axe at Créon.
Thanks. I have to second Vardit's recommendation of this paper, because it's a wonderful historical overview of some of the large moments in, particularly in American bioethics, that sets the scene for its progression and for its analysis of the major challenges that were facing bioethics in the 1970s, the 80s, and the 90s. For me, it was a bit, in reading this paper and thinking about how to respond to it, going back to some of my early work during my PhD and my postdoc, when I was thinking about genetic tests, the commercialization of genetic technologies, how they were being developed. And in reading this paper, and I think Vardit did a great overview of the key moments that the paper identifies as challenges for bioethics, we start getting some of a sense of what's the focus that the field has taken towards these sorts of questions. And so one of the focuses was the individual perspective, attention to the notion of informed consent, of autonomy, of choice, fundamental ethical principles that are inscribed in our liberal democracies, in our codes of human rights. We take these things for granted. And in our analysis and in the paper that Davis presents, we get this focus on informed consent and the challenges that these technologies, as they're becoming more widespread in their implementation, are raising for the ability for people to freely choose the types of medical interventions that they're living with. An interesting element in this story is a shift in the way the technologies are developed and then implemented. And so one of the things I wanted to talk about briefly was the difference in context and the importance for an ethical analysis to pay attention to the context in which the technology is being deployed. The challenges that Davis brings up in her discussion of PSA testing, of prenatal screening, and neonatal screening are challenges developed in an American context. And in that context, we have to understand also what are the drivers that led to the particular ways that these technologies were implemented. So PSA screening, neonatal, and prenatal. One of the major drivers, I would say, for all of these is a combination of two elements. It's the technological imperative and physician liability. The technological imperative is we've got a technology, we have to use it. The physician liability aspect is we've got a technology, we have to use it, and if we don't use it, we'll get sued. In all of these cases, the technology is something that provides information. It provides information about predisposition, provides often risk information, occasionally it's diagnostic. In a context where American physicians may be spending $20,000 or $30,000 a year on medical liability insurance, the fear of negligence lawsuits is enormous. So it's also a driver for the shaping of clinical practice guidelines and public policy. So what we saw in the US was the normalization of technologies that were initially developed for individuals that become implemented as a population level intervention, that become public health technologies or tools. But the driver is not necessarily the one that we would see in other contexts, as in Canada or in Europe. What we're seeing in the US, the driver is we must have all the information that's possible, and if we've got a new tool, we must use it. Because the fear is links to suits around medical negligence and some really problematic legal concepts around wrongful life, wrongful birth, where if the child is born with a disability, we're then going to sue the doctor because the child was born with this disability. And if we'd known as parents that this child had this particular medical predisposition, we would have done something different. We would have maybe aborted. We would have done some other sort of intervention, possibly. So the doctor should have given us the information. If the information is potentially available, it must be provided. So that's the one of the major drivers for the use of these technologies. And so why we see in the US across the states something like between 30 and 50 neonatal screening that's being used for everything, for every baby that's born. And there's no questions asked. It's just done. But in most cases, the vast majority of these conditions that are being screened for, there's no possible intervention. The baby's born, and then you test genetically, and you find out that they're at risk for this range of conditions. But there's nothing we can do about the vast majority of them. PKU was used as the model, phenylketonuria. We can intervene, we can change the diet. But the vast majority of health conditions aren't like that. The genetics, the information that we're getting says your child is at risk of this disease. But the information is the only resource that's available. In Canada, in Western Europe, we've seen very different approaches. We're not screening for 30, 50 conditions. We're screening for maybe half a dozen. And the focus has been on what are the conditions that we can actually intervene and make a difference about. So there's a difference because the model isn't one of medical liability as a key driver. It's one that's based on a different set of issues. In part, it's the functioning of the healthcare system. In the US, the model is a private healthcare system. The vast majority of people have private health insurance, either from an employer or through private plans they purchase themselves. In Canada, in most of Western Europe, they're mixed private and public plans, but the vast majority of medical insurance or health insurance is state subsidized and is block budget funded. So the intervention, the motivator, the interest, isn't at the level of individuals accessing the system. It's at the level of decision makers who have a budget and then have to decide, what do we spend it on? So do we want to spend it on 30 genetic tests for newborns, or do we want to spend it on 5 that we can actually do something about? So you get different types of economic constraints on the way decisions are made about what types of resources will then be provided to the population. So that's a contextual difference, which has a huge impact on the way services are then provided and raises different types of ethical issues for individuals who are then accessing these services. So another difference then is we don't have the medical liability concern. It exists among North American physicians in general, including Canadians, because they read the American literature. It's much less in terms of actual numbers of cases. But it's not a major driver of public policy decision making. The major driver, I would suggest, is an economic driver and a public health driver. The interests are different. In Canada, when we're putting in place different types of screening programs, whether it's neonatal, whether it's adult, the focus, I would argue, is public health driven. It's a very different way of looking at the issue. The language that we've used in the US, and also, and this is where we have an ethical problem, the language that we often use in Canada is one of individual choice. So we say to women, the reason you're having a prenatal ultrasound, the reason you're getting this genetic testing is to allow you to choose, to be informed, to have an autonomous choice. But that's not what's actually going on, I don't think. It's a rhetoric that doesn't map on to the motivations behind the service provision. I think the motivations are ones of public health. We want to reduce the incidence of particular health conditions. That may be a laudable objective, but there's a disconnect between what we tell patients or women who we're treating now as patients, which is another separate issue, and the motivation for making that service available. I would suggest that the motivation is a public health motivation around reducing the incidence of disability. Now, with my colleagues in public health, this is considered normal practice. When we put in place a public health campaign to promote healthy diet, reduce smoking, engage in exercise, climb the stairs in the university, we're trying to shape population behavior with a particular goal in mind, which is to improve health. Totally laudable. But the way we do it may be up to question. What is the arguments that we use? What is the language that we use? It is a language that's built around autonomy and liberal choice, but in fact, the motivator is public health and economics. Because the reason we put in place these public health prevention campaigns, in part, is because it's expensive to deal with people who are ill. In the case of prenatal testing or neonatal, the issue is how do we reduce either the existence of children born with a disability, who will be costly, or provide a service that will allow us to intervene quickly. The cost factor is an important one. It's a legitimate interest on the part of the state. It's a limited resource. those have to come into consideration because they are fundamental interests at play in the way public policy is being set and the way decision makers are deciding what services to provide. The problem, however, is when that's not what's being told to participants, whether research participants or whether patients undergoing an intervention. It's made all the more problematic, and Davis is really good at naming this, in that we normalize interventions. So it's just normal practice that when you're having a baby, you have ultrasounds. It's just normal. They're baby pictures. And that's what women get told. Here's the baby picture. And if you spend an extra $100, you can have the three-dimensional baby picture. Wow, this is fabulous. What people aren't told is this is a genetic test. It's an early genetic test, and we'll look at whether there's a physical malformation. That will then provide information about, are we going to intervene? Are we going to stop the pregnancy? But people aren't told that. And we're also not being told as citizens, as patients, what the motivation behind that is. There's a disconnect between the rhetoric and between the interests that are being put forward. So I would suggest, given this context and inspired by the paper that Davis provides for us, a challenge but also an opportunity for bioethics in our applied ethics reflection is to think about these disconnects and to also draw on conceptual tools that don't come from traditional clinical ethics. It's in the emerging fields of public health ethics, population health ethics, that we start finding other concepts, other tools that we need to bring to bear. Because by looking at health promotion campaigns that have nothing to do with genetics, we see concerns around the use of particular rhetoric, the use of moralizing language that blames the population for certain types of negative behavior. We then get into concerns around soft or hard paternalism. How do we influence the population, and when is that influence justified? Is it okay to blame people for smoking and say, you're bad, you should not smoke? That's a pretty rough message. But we've used that in public health campaigns because it's effective. But we're now intervening with individual liberty, and we're moralizing. We're saying to people, you're a bad person if you engage in this behavior. We may do it more subtly. We may present pictures of people who are obese and then cast it in a negative light. It's a way of shaping individual identity and behavior. The questions that are ethical, that are important to ask in the development of these health campaigns and the rhetoric that's used is this language justified? Is this type of soft paternalism acceptable, and in what context? It's obviously going to vary depending on the context, depending on the way it's deployed. So there's a lot of inspiration that we can draw from this other area of thinking to think about the particular cases that Davis presents. Because what we're seeing is a fusing between individual context, individual use of technology that are implied and deployed in a public health context with different motivators. Those are some of the major challenges, I think, for bioethics. And it then brings in sub-issues around the role of health professionals who are working as individual clinicians facing a patient, but then are also engaged in a public health context where they may have other considerations that go beyond the patient, that raise considerations around justice, around allocation of resources, about dealing with the other 500 people on the waiting list. Those are challenges that we haven't often thought about in traditional clinical bioethics. So by having these challenges raised in the context of public health, it forces us to go in new directions, but equally it provides us with new conceptual opportunities to explore, to test, to collaborate with our colleagues in the professions who are deploying these mechanisms to see whether it's the right thing to do and whether we can do differently.
Thank you, Bryn.